We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Feel like Kobe in the fourth quarter.
This is the Dane Moore NBA podcast brought to you by Blue Wire Podcasts. Happy Memorial Day. It is Sunday evening as we sit down to record tonight's episode of the show, which means in the context of the NBA playoffs, we're in round one, about three or four games into each of the series. A couple days ago, Britt and I talked about five of those first round series. So tonight we're going to hit on the other three. My guest is Glenn Willis. Glenn, we are going to hit on Hawks-Knicks, Grizzlies-Jazz, and Sixers-Wizards. Glenn, you cover the Atlanta Hawks for Peachtree Hoops, so obviously that's why I wanted to have you on. That's where I want to start this conversation. I think it's been one of the most fun series of this playoffs. You texted me on Friday night because we knew we were getting together to do this. You said, "Dane, the Knicks are done," and I didn't respond to your text because I was watching the game on delay. But now game three plays out and game four plays out. They kill the Knicks tonight. What was the final? It was 113-96. It's now a 3-1 series lead. I mean, you're right. Like the Knicks seem done. Why, Glenn, why are the Knicks done in this series after four games?
Yeah, I think you know, that was mostly predicated on when I saw Nate McMillan in the second quarter of game three switch DeAndre Hunter from being the primary Julius Randle defender to defending Derrick Rose. That said to me that they can now kind of focus their best perimeter and point of attack defense on Rose, the guy who had actually been problematic and who was playing really well and driving a lot of their offense. And when you kind of, you know, look at that Knicks roster and look at their rotation, for me, I just didn't see another offensive solution that Tibbs could find there. I thought, you know, RJ Barrett could get more opportunity and was probably deserving of that, depending on how they could maybe work some certain matchups or mismatches for him and things like that. But I didn't think that was going to kind of lift them all the way up to where I thought they needed to be.
Right.
So, you know, I think that, you know, as good as the Knicks were all year long, especially on defense, and the way that they found enough in the regular season offensively to kind of post the record that they did, when you get into a playoff context and the other team is planning for you for, you know, typically multiple weeks worth of games and feedback loops and all that sort of stuff, you've got to have sort of options on alternatives. And so, you know, I think it's kind of a cliche at this point, but the Knicks basically were built for the regular season, I think we could say now. And that's not to single out any of their players as being kind of regular season players, you know, but just the composite of their full roster, I just think there's not enough secondary, tertiary, you know, offensive options to kind of tweak things and go look for more offensive juice. They just don't have it, in my view.
Right. Well, I think we would have said that, you know, before the series even started,
right,
that if the Knicks are going to win this series, it's going to be because you get a lot offensively from Derrick Rose and Julius Randle. And I'm assuming Tibbs in his wildest dreams didn't expect Randle to, you know, to do what he's done. He's, I mean, kind of the counting stats look decent. He's averaging 17 and 11, shooting 33% from three, but 24% from two, true shooting percentage of 40%. I mean, he's been awful. And when you are a team that has been, like the Knicks, when they were good in the regular season, it's because Randall's scoring for them. It starts with him scoring, which opens up his playmaking, kind of gets to the nail and is able to distribute. And then that's what kind of engages the other kind of role players, the Reggie Bullocks, the Nerlens Noel on a lob, something like that. And outside of that, really their only extra juice is Derrick Rose. Now, Rose is for sure giving him juice on his end of it, but when Randle isn't going, the whole idea of their identity, the whole idea of why the Knicks works, the idea that they were a good regular season team kind of falls apart, because that is, Julius Randle was their foundation. So in your view, what have the Hawks done to take Julius Randle away?
Well, I mean, if any of your listeners watch Hawks Knicks in the regular season, Knicks swept all three games, and Randle just, I mean, posted bonkers numbers against them, and he was a ridiculous shot maker. It wasn't a super outlier because he shot the ball well all year long, you know.
Right, right.
But what's been different basically is with Hunter on him, you know, Hunter is kind of crowding him and taking away his space, and Drano likes to kind of dribble into some space to work with, and Hunter's just taking that away. Now, Gallo has been kind of the second defender from a number of minutes. He's kind of taken up that responsibility. And he's done something different. He's dropped about 8 to 10 feet off of him and has just decided that Randall's not going to dribble past him, which is kind of funny. I didn't see that coming. I'll be really honest with that. I consider myself a smart-ish basketball person. I didn't expect that. I didn't anticipate that at all. But it's worked quite well. And
I mean, they traded him. Gallo treats him like he's Giannis.
Exactly.
Which I think, again, if we're having this conversation a week ago and we're like, oh, well, Gallo's going to play 8 feet off of Julius Randle. Julius Randle, who was one of the best shot makers in the of the whole season this year in the NBA, right. You would just think, you'd think he'd be having 30 a game because he'd just pull up. He'd pull up over and over again. But, I mean, Randle, not once in any of the four games has he got going on that. He doesn't have the confidence in it. And really, like, I'm almost surprised he hasn't tried to just shoot his way out of it, because it's not there. It's not there when he's trying to go north and south, because it's not just Gallo walling up. They're bringing that second body over there. Even like when John Collins got like wrecked in the face today, that was one of the times where Randle actually got downhill, right?
Right.
And he got past Gallo, but there's that second body there, and it looks like Randle's best drive of the day. And then sure enough, you know, it's an offensive foul. So they've just totally loaded up on him and treated him like Giannis. And for some reason, he's had the same. His jumper's been as bad as Giannis's. It's I did not see the narrative of Gallo's defense being one of the reasons why the Hawks are, you know, killing it in this series.
Yeah, Gallo had a rough offensive first game, and that's where it seems like what 90-95% of his value comes kind of across the season, right. But he still had a good game because of what he did defensively on Randle. And I mean, part of that, he talked about them walling up. If you kind of pause the game on any Knicks offensive possessions when Randle's on the court, you'll see at least kind of four guys touching the paint, and sometimes a fifth guy, depending on where the ball is. You know, I don't personally want to put all that on Randle. He's been bad at, you know, what's going on with him. Is it playoff pressure? Is first playoff experience? Is it, you know, who knows what's, I don't want to try to kind of guess at that. But one of the parts of that that's made Julius Randle's job harder is that the Hawks don't really worry about any kind of secondary creators on the weak side. The ball swings over to whether it's Bullock or Burks or whoever. They know that, you know, if we just chase them off the three-point line, they don't have great dribble skills. They're not going to really kind of create. They may step in for a shot, a 17-footer or whatever, a value of 2 points and stuff. But they can load up, and they can kind of show a lot of bodies to the ball handler, whoever that is, and not really worry about pulling it on the weak side because there's just not a lot of creators. I mean, probably year three or year four for R.J. Barrett, he's – probably developing into. Yeah, for sure. A little unfair to expect that, I think, right now with him, even though he's had some flashes where he's been a tough, you know, thing for them to deal with. But they just, there's nobody on that weak side. I think sometimes in basketball conversation, we talk about just put a great shooter in the weak side corner and that creates your spacing. But honestly, in a playoff context, more, it's somewhat in the regular season, but especially in the playoff context, if you know that all you gotta do is hustle out to that shooter and force him to put the ball in the court and chase him out of the corner, if that guy doesn't really have kind of dribble, you know, slash creation skills, you're going to live with kind of whatever happens when that type of person puts the ball on the floor. And Alex Burks fits that description, I think. And so does Reggie Bullock. They're living with that. So, where else does the coaching staff, turn? And the Hawks have kind of become even a little bit more precise every game with kind of how they're doing that. It was funny in game one where Rose had the floater that tied the game before Trey's floater. Yeah. Even though Rose made the floater and tied the game, I thought it was one of the Hawks' best defensive possessions of that game because they chased like three guys off the 3-point line and forced them to dribble the ball, inside. And that's probably been their best phase of defensive play across the whole series is how they've been pulling in, but then really working hard to close out and chase guys off the 3-point line. That, in my mind, I wrote about it, but I said, just forcing a 2-pointer that resulted in a tie game when the Hawks went down to trade the game winner, there's so much less pressure when you're dealing with a tie game where if you miss, you're going to overtime instead of being down one. And so how hard they worked on defense, despite there was a made basket by the other team, was huge. And so, in terms of, where the Knicks go from here, when they look at their roster for next year, I think they definitely need to look at more creation. And Dane, you and I have always talked a lot about how valuable it is to throw your team into a playoff environment because it gives you a really valuable feedback loop on what you actually have and what you don't have. And, me as a really optimistic person, and I kind of root for everyone unless a person gives me a really great reason not to. And I think this is a feedback loop for the Knicks that they need more creators on the wing. I think RJ is on that path, but they need one or two, if not three more, if they want to kind of get the team to a point where they are set up to be able to kind of handle what the things that they're going to counter in the postseason. I think that's the big takeaway for me.
Yeah, which – and then that's a whole nother sort of topic. You start questioning the whole kind of design of the roster. It's like, you feel like not only could they use a creator, they could probably use another just catch and shoot 3-point guy, in addition to Bullock out there or whatever it might be. And so long as they have one of their five positions being taken up by Nerlens Noel and Taj Gibson, who have been very good for them defensively, like those guys aren't providing you anything there. So in ways like, knowing Tibbs a little bit, I don't think Tibbs will do this, but like an option would be to shift Randall up to the five. And now you can put, four shooter slashers around him and, at least unlock a little bit more opportunity there. Yet their defense is what makes them so special and what Nerlens Noel has brought for them as a rim defender and Taj in a similar way. I think this kind of loops back to your initial point where you're like, well, they're kind of a team that's built for regular season success. And that's what we've, a lot of times with these centers in the league, this isn't the first series we've hit this on where it's like, man, we need more out of that position offensively. When it's just a guy who lives in the dunker spot, like Taj or Noel, who have actually done good in the dunker spot, it's just overall limiting to them. So I'm watching these games trying to think of, what do you even add to this Knicks team to make them better for next season? And really, I think you have to kind of question the whole structure of Tibbs' system and the roster that they're building out here, because just Randall making shots, I don't know, like if he comes back next year and he's a shot maker in the playoffs, still we have a lot of these problems that would translate. The thing I wanted to, you mentioned, it's RJ Barrett. I don't know if we can, expect that much of him in his first playoff series. Oh, it's Julius Randle. He's 26, 27. It's his first playoff series. There's this pressure here. And it's been kind of fascinating in these playoffs, whether it's John Morant, who we'll talk about in a little bit, or some of these guys are getting their first taste. and it's not a problem at all. And Trey is kind of the prime, you know, the prime example of this. I have his, you know, stats pulled up. I mean, God, his numbers are insane. 27.5, 10 assists, 37% high volume from three, over 50% from two, high usage. I mean, Trey has been, Trey's been everything you could have wanted him to be in this series. And it's his first shot at it. I mean, as somebody who covers that team and has followed Trey throughout his career, did you expect this out of Trey, or did you also kind of come into the series thinking like, well, you know, it's his first one, it might take him a little while to get his feet wet, blah, blah, blah. Like, what is your opinion of Trey been early on?
Yeah, he surprised me. Like, my official prediction was Hawks in seven. I thought the Knicks would take some control early just because they had the kind of a simplified way of playing that sometimes serves a team well early in the series. Hawks run a lot more sophisticated stuff, and sometimes that can work against you, especially if you have a team that's new to the playoffs and I'm feeling a little overwhelmed and things like that. But Trey typically, starts, we could go back to the way he looked in the first few games of Summer League, which is obviously a totally different thing. You kind of go back to his one game in the March Madness tournament, which you only get one, you know, if you lose. And he typically has a pattern of kind of trying too hard and forcing things early on. And that's what surprised me the most. I thought by game three or four, he would kind of find a rhythm and find a gear that wasn't too high and not too low and kind of gave him an opportunity to a degree to control the game. And that fact that that's been there from basically the first possession of the series, that's been pretty shocking to me. I don't know where it came from. I don't know what kind of preparation went into it, but
isn't it just maturity, Glenn? I mean, you're talking about what he did when he was 18 in college or 19 in summer league. Like, I think it's awareness born out of, which I'm not saying I would have bet on this to happen either, but like, once you see it happen and you go that he has been patient, he's been loud in this series, but like, he has been patient. He's been diligent and, you know, everything, he looks like a vet. And I think that's just, I talk about this all the time with the Wolves having a constant like cycle of young guys. You're like, well, when are they going to flip the adult switch on? You know, like when, and what, you know, what can that signal for when we try and bake in when guys are going to make a leap? And a lot of times I think it just ends up being mental maturity where you're reading the game, not just your individual matchup and your own way to like get yourself off. Like Trey's getting himself off. He's averaging 27 and 10, but particularly in game one, right? Like he was slow with it. He didn't get to the free throw line until the fourth quarter and has found a way, got bogey going in the first game. Like he's played point guard. And that, right? I mean, that's been the whole thing under Nate McMillan is like Trey Young really became a point guard of this team, which is still like an initiator, but also, I mean, this has been the thing since he came out, right? Like he's a playmaker. Passing is as good of a skill set of his as is his shooting. He's just in previous years, relied more on that shot creation rather than that playmaking ability. And we're seeing it now with 10 assists a game in this series involving everyone.
Yeah. And, I thought today in game four, he started a little bit amped up. He was a little quick, had a bit of a quick trigger from really long range today. That's where I think some of his age kind of started to show through. Totally, in a four game sample, you for sure live with that and you're really pleased with what you've seen. But even the fact that, you know, like you mentioned, he didn't shoot any free throws the first three quarters of game one. In the regular season, he would have been chirping at the refs. You would have seen him maybe distracted, him playing maybe a little out of control, trying to kind of force something. And that's what surprised me the most was that never happened. You never really saw him interacting with the refs more than any other player in the league does. You saw him kind of focusing on his job as a lead scorer and a distributor and a guy who is kind of setting things up. And that has been, you know, really shocking. It's kind of funny how I've seen some things going on Twitter, like people saying like, can you believe Trey Young didn't make the All-Star team, you know? And when, of course, when you watch him in the context of this, he looks like one of the, what, 15 best players in the playoffs right now. You know, I don't want to do that exercise and get that exact list, but he's in one of the best 24.
But yes, to answer your question, yes, right. Like, for sure.
Right. But every player looks better, and it's easier to recognize the value in the a lot of the nuanced players bring when the team is winning. And like, for example, when we were headed towards the All-Star break, the Hawks weren't winning, and that's just going to kind of provide a filter, natural, you know, thing, you know, for observers to kind of see a player through and things like that. And the conversation around Trey year one and two was, oh, he's putting up big stats on a team that doesn't win any games. And like all things, there was some truth to that. And there was, you know, some you know, narrative that unwarranted, probably to a degree, narrative there. But now you can kind of see what he's capable of doing. But, you know, I think he really trusts Bogdanović as kind of a backcourt meet. When Collins leaves the four, for example, Gallo comes in, they upgrade their shooting at the four when the backup four. I mean, how many teams can you say that about? You know, not right. Not many. And so, you know, the roster construction for the Hawks this year has been quite perfect, you know, for Trey. That's not to say they're done, and they've got to continue to evolve if they want to be an actual contender down the line. But, you know, the idea, you put a ton of shooting around Trey and kind of set him loose, that's going to give you probably 80% of what you need in offense. And the rest is around, you know, things like how do you get Hunter enough touches, and then how do you keep Capella involved, whatever that stuff is. You know, you're going to be in a pretty good place. But the Knicks are awesome defensively, and they've played, I think, good defense for the most part in this series. It's just that Trey has, for whatever reason, we could talk for hours about what he's doing and stuff like that, but he's just controlled things from the first minute of game one, basically.
From my Timberwolves listeners' standpoint, I think a lot of Timberwolves fans are going to be watching this series, or just other teams that know John Collins is a free agent this summer. And Collins has done very, very little in this series, and a lot of that is the way the roster is constructed, and, you know, Capella gets in the way, and yada yada yada. Like, we can go down. Like, Collins is not in a spot to succeed on that team right now.
I totally agree.
Yet at the same time, like, he's not really. He's very, very much not doing anything more than what a playoff role player would provide you. Like, his numbers aren't bad. They're just muted. I think he's like, I have it here somewhere. He's like, he's shooting 40% from three, but it's like 10 threes. Right. And he's getting you like 12.6 points. It's just at the end of the day, he's not playing in the playoffs like a player who's about to get $100 million in free agency, which is, again, from a Timberwolves standpoint, the Wolves and Hawks have been connected in, you know, in that sense, and just from a Hawks standpoint of building going forward, like, you gotta leave this playoffs whenever they end kind of with the idea, right, that John Collins is expendable. Is that what the narrative kind of is in Atlanta world right now?
That's a word I hear a lot, and I think there's a really interesting conversation to have around, you know, what is it worth to retain him, you know, on this Hawks team. Don't get me wrong, he's a good player, a really good player. He gives you easy offense. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at his true shooting, and, you know, got like an average 18 points a game on, you know, a really efficient game. He's pretty dependent on a distributor to be his best, for sure. But you also have to respect the fact that he's really developed himself as a shooter kind of across the league too. But, you know, those average per game numbers, he basically did nothing in game two because of all the foul trouble he was in. He didn't play a ton of minutes. He had a really good game today in game four. But he's the kind of guy, like, the offense, the Hawks.
Yeah, but Glenn, he had like a good game for a role player. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's not.
Yeah, well, that's what I was about to say. He had the kind of game that when a team's offense kind of really starts clicking, he's going to soak up numbers. Because of his ability to run and jump and shoot.
For sure.
You know, so he's going to kind of benefit from the offense overall hitting a high gear. If you go watch a game where he gets 25 to 30 points, it's typically when the Hawks' overall offense was clicking. And when he's, like, spotting up in the corner and knocking down those shots, or even attacking an average defender, closing out on him, I mean, that's when he's going to shine. But if you kind of take a step back and try to figure out, like, okay, the Hawks went all in financially this past summer. You know, I get it, well, fall technically, but you know what I mean. And now he's a restricted free agent. You know, what do? You know, his best value proposition to the team is that he can, as a big in the pick and roll, he can do both roles. He can dive to the rim, and he's one of the, you know, better lob threats and finishers at the rim, and he can kind of pop to the three-point line and knock down shots there. So that allows for this Hawks team, for example, he can play with Capella and allow Capella to dive, and he'll spot up on the three-point line. He can play with Gallo, let Gallo spot up, and he'll dive to the rim, and he makes all of that combination of fours and fives work, which is great, which is awesome, which helps kind of your rotation. It helps with some continuity around kind of having fives consistently doing one thing, the fours another. But then you ask yourself, how much can you spend on that? How much is versatility worth? You know, can you spend, you know, $22.5 million a year or whatever on a guy who's bringing versatility and kind of becoming a rotation glue guy, making everyone else, he enables everyone else to fit into the role that fits them. He allows Capella to do what he does well, Gallo, et cetera, et cetera. You can even say the same about kind of Solomon Hill. But how much can you spend on a guy when that's the prime, not the, all of the value, but the primary value he brings to the team? That, I think that's a really hard question to answer.
Yeah. Well, if it's, you know, if it's up for debate, if he's quote unquote worth it on that team, it would be your view that there is another team that he would be more valuable on, correct?
It could be. It really, the Hawks are not spending a ton of money at the five and at the four right now. I mean, Gallo's got a pretty big contract, but it's basically a 2-year deal. And so in my mind, if a team's built around a really high usage center, I don't know who that team might be, then, you know, there's the opportunity to possibly even kind of service more value in him than what the Hawks can do, because Collins could come out of a game where he has 10 points and 9 rebounds and a block, and Capello and Gallo shined the whole game because they were staying in their roles. And unless you were watching the Hawks consistently kind of game to game all year, you might not realize how much value Collins brought to his teammates in that situation.
Right.
But, you know, if you're a team that's going to play through a Towns or, you know, someone like that, then, you know, his versatility to do a lot of different things to kind of, you know, set up Towns, for example, that's probably a higher value proposition situation for a guy like him than,
right,
than with Atlanta.
Yeah, so that's where I'm kind of at with it from a Wolves perspective is, like, I wouldn't have a problem, Matt, if you could go out and get Collins at, you know, 4 years. What were we thinking the number is? Like 4 years, 100, 4 years, one, you said 22 and a half?
I think my guess, if I had to kind of put a median
over
kind
under,
of guess,
yeah.
4-110 is probably where I think he kind of lands.
See, so... So I could, like, I think that's, like, questionable, but I could get behind that. Like, you kind of got to go if you're the Wolves, like, that, you know, that makes sense. You probably got to clear some salary elsewhere. That I think what I would be really, that's not what the only question is. It's not from a Wolves perspective. It's not, or any other team's perspective. It's not just, is he worth 4 years, 110? It's also going to be like a sign and trade, right? That, I mean, that's, I'm assuming that's how the Hawks would maneuver this. Like, I don't think they're just going to straight let him walk there. And I know sign and trades are often kind of, you know, small in terms of compensation. But if you look at it from a Wolves perspective, it's like, all right, we're putting that 22 mil like that you got to send out. Like, how do you put that money together? And like, Ricky Rubio isn't exactly a great deal at $18 million, but he is, you know, he has some value to this team in Anthony Edwards and just in that sort of way. I don't think the Hawks would want Ricky Rubio. So now you're kind of talking about Malik Beasley, something like that. It's just, it's not just, if you could just sign him to, I should say this, if you can just sign him as a restricted free agent and outbid the Hawks, you know, you do it. But if it is a sign and trade, like, they're going to probably hold you over the barrel to some degree and force that to happen or match themselves, like, to prevent them from matching, you're going to have to pay up a little extra. And I don't know exactly what that would be. And that would could get me to a point where I would say this might not be worth it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the thing for me is that the sign and trade for restricted free agents specifically, I think most of them right now have been resulting in basically a trade exception and not a real, not an actual player. I think if we go back, a few years, we see Rozier going to Charlotte. I mean, that's what you got for Kemba Walker. I'm sorry, but that's not, super impressive to me. And so I think teams buy themselves basically 12 months to kind of turn that into something else. They hope when that can happen. And so I agree with you. The Hawks are unlikely to just kind of let him walk if it gets to a number where they think, I think the thing for me is that the Hawks could see themselves saying, let's throw a lot of money at Collins to make sure we have him on our books next season. But it's that 4 years at that value. And then, as you and I know, a lot of teams are going to try to, convince the Hawks to not match are going to throw trade kickers and, all that stuff on there. And so we'll see. But, as a person who roots for the Hawks as a fan, setting that aside when I write and analyze, I think if they do a sign a trade, it's probably what, like 70% likely they're getting an exception back and buying themselves 12 months something to do with it. And not a lot more. I mean, can like a Culver or someone like, a Culver plus what other salary might work with that? Is that interesting enough, to get something back, sort of a roll of the dice with a guy like that? I mean, who knows? But, it is interesting to think about how his value proposition changes in different environments. But at the same time, if you have a team that doesn't play through the point guard, I think you have to be a little cautious about him too, because that's basically what he's been in with Trey since his year two. But
Glenn, that's D'Lo though. Like, they're gonna play through D'Lo too. Like, D'Lo in ways is like Trey, right? That'd be the same idea. A pick and roll with Collins. Like, that's how you would use him, or maybe Ant develop some of that. Not that those guys are on Trey's level necessarily, but yeah, I mean that's what the Wolves just got to figure out. Who are they playing through in general? Like, how much is this going to be a Cat thing? How much is this going to be a D'Lo Ant? But I think that's why Collins, what Collins could do for any team is whoever the point guard is, really up that point guard to another level, because, like you mentioned, he's an elite rim rolling option. He's also a solid pick and pop option. Like, that's whatever team you put John Collins on, he's going to make whoever the point guard is a lot better.
Yeah, I agree. That makes sense. And that's going to be one of the most fascinating things that happens time for free agency and all of that. It's going to be super fascinating to see what happens there for sure.
Well, we'll wrap up the Hawks part on that. Let's take a quick break and then come back and talk some another point guard who is making his debut in the playoffs with Ja Morant and the Memphis Grizzlies and their series against the Utah Jazz. We'll be back in a second. Look, no one's perfect. So if you feel like you come up short in the bedroom sometimes, it's perfectly okay. But if it's bothering you, there are options. Go to GetRoman.com/more now. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. A U.S. licensed healthcare professional will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, it ships to you free with 2-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward and discreet. Getting started is simple. Just go to GetRoman.com/more and complete an online visit. Take care of your ED without leaving home. Complete an online visit today to connect with a doctor and take care of it. Go to GetRoman.com/more now to get $15 off your first month. Look, there's a straightforward way to take care of your ED. GetRoman.com/more. Get started now to save $15 on your first month of treatment. If you love listening to podcasts, if you love listening to this podcast, nothing's stopping you from grabbing a mic and starting your own show. There's no better place to start hosting your own podcast than Blue Wire Hustle. Hustle was created to give everyone the opportunity to take their podcast to the next level. Or if you want to host a podcast and just don't know where to start, Hustle is also the perfect place. As part of the program, you'll receive personal cover art for your pod, Q&As with Blue Wire's podcasters, access to our community Discord, and an e-learning course full of tips and tricks. And on top of that, we'll help you get your show pushed out to Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, all those listening platforms. And the best part is you can get all of this for only $15 a month, the same rate any hosting site will charge you to just have the initial setup done for your podcast. So if you're ready to do more than just listen to me talk about hoops, then make your voice heard in Hustle. Acceptance into the program is limited, so get your application in today. To apply, go to bwhustle.com/join. Check out the description box in this episode to find out more, but that's bwhustle.com/join. All right, Glenn, so I've been watching this Grizzlies series and seeing what Ja Morant has been doing, and quite frankly been surprised that it, I mean, not that Ja hasn't been good this year, but really, like, the recent kind of comparison to Ja from what we've seen from Ja early on is kind of like Luka last year almost, right? And this ability to be a star player when in his second year in the league. And we just don't, there's none of the test in the water for him. It's the same thing with Trey, that he's come in and, you know, and been a superstar right away. And whether they win or lose this series, they're down 2-1 right now. Like, How does what Ja has shown in this series kind of sort of change your perspective of the trajectory of the Grizzlies?
Yeah, I mean, it's especially in the, even though they lost the game, that big offensive performance he had in game two, just his ability to, against, you know, one of the better defensive teams in the league. Utah's been one of the best defensive teams in the league. They have, you know, what, you know, a lot of people consider Rudy Gobert to be the best defensive center in the league, that he can still get into the heart of that defense and get inside relatively easy, just opens the door for the Grizzlies to kind of create a lot from that. Now, you know, when you see Ja not always helping his team, is him doing young stuff, which is, you should be completely expected, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, kind of discount my, you know, expectations for him in the future because of any of that. You know, he'll force shots at the rim, force, you know, highly contested shots at the rim, but maybe he make a different decision. But it's not like he's doing that typically all game long. You'll see him kind of get to a situation where he's, you know, there are 3 or 4 minutes left, they're down, say, 8 or 10 points, and he's trying to kind of put his team on his back, which I think, right, says a lot of mostly, you know, good stuff about him being a guy who's willing to kind of step up and try to make something happen at that point in the game. He's not the most dynamic passer. I don't think he'll ever be. He's a good passer. He's just not kind of in that elite tier of passing kind of from anywhere on the court. He's really good at the pick and roll. He can make all the passes in the pick and roll and things like that. But I think that, you know, what I expect of him going forward is a guy who can carry a heavy, heavy scoring workload. He's easily a good enough passer to punish teams that commit extra defenders to him. And, you know, what he does in the pick and roll, which is a league-wide staple, and, you know, with Taylor Jenkins be out of the bud / pop tree, there's a heavy kind of presence of that there. To me, kind of the sky's the limit, so long as he can cut down on his bad decisions and his mistakes. And I don't know why, based upon everything we hear about the work ethic he has, how hard he works, how committed he is to his team and his teammates, I don't know of any reason to not be optimistic that he's just going to get better and better. And this is, you know, one of the reasons I think teams do well to sneak into an 8 seed, when other people might say, well, tank, just, right, going to get bounced, go tank, go get another draft pick. The experience that your franchise guy, Ja Morant, is getting in this series, especially if you can get this to like at least 6 games. I mean, I don't know how to put a price tag on that. So he's
just the information you're getting, right? Like,
for sure,
that, you know, that, like, you got to feel a lot. I mean, they probably already believed in Ja a lot, that he could be a number one guy, but somebody who was maybe more skeptical, you would be like, well, you know, I don't know. Like, we think Ja's going to be a really good player in this league, but now I think, and granted, it's only 3 games, so we don't got to crown him a superstar in the league just off of 3 games. But I think you not only are getting him the experience, I think you're giving yourself, to use the term you used before, an information loop of like the trajectory of this team could be different because now we can feel confident that Ja Morant is going to be a 1A guy on on a team. He's illustrated this again against a great defense in Utah, and that he can be dynamic without his shot even kind of being of any sort of weapon, right, from three. And I guess that's where, if we're going glass half empty, you start to wonder about it, is like, are there ways where a team could wall up against him and turn him into a jump shooter? That will probably, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, that'll probably determine where he can really go, is where his jump shot goes. Is he going to be Derrick Rose circa Bulls, or is he going to be a pick and roll player more like Luka Doncic in that sort of way? And I think the improved quality of his jump shot will determine kind of his upside.
Yeah, the jump shot is key for sure. And, you know, I mean, it's so hard to predict like which guys can, you know, kind of become, go from where he is to become like a reliable 38-ish% shooter, which is phenomenal for a guy who plays off the dribble like Ja does. You know, he doesn't need to get there to be really, really, really good, but that we're talking about like all NBA level year to year, that's maybe kind of where he needs to get. But in addition to that, if you watch him play and if you're kind of really, you know, sometimes have to watch a play several times, watch, you know, a possession and kind of play, watch it a few times to kind of work through his own progressions and reads. You know, if I'm coaching against him and trying to defend him, I'm trying to get him to take a kind of what I would describe as a running attempt near the rim. When he gets to 2 feet inside of about 10 feet from the basket and kind of get that base, he has such good verticality and such good balance that that's when he's good. When you can convince him he has a narrow shot at a layup, whether off the backboard of the rim, and it's more of a kind of a passing attempt as he flies through the lane, that to me, that's cleaning up his kind of layup decision making and his rim decision making is probably step one and the most important thing for me, for him to really maximize his really elite ability to penetrate with the dribble. And I would put the perimeter shot as kind of a pretty close second, but that's my view. I just, you know,
interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, I've seen so many times where Trey, you know, especially before he had this good team put around him this year, would make that decision and it ends up being not only a lower percentage shot than maybe he thought before he kind of made that decision, but he also ends up on the ground on the baseline and his team is running back and setting up to defend, you know, 4-on-5. And Ja puts himself and his team in that situation a lot. Now, Trey did that a ton in year one and two, and that's one of the things he's cleaned up this year that's helped them in the playoffs. But, you know, when I try to imagine as a person with a coaching background, what does it look like for Ja to get there? It's reps in the gym, practice, player development, you know, environment, all of that. And Memphis has a super strong player development culture to what they do. Ja, by all accounts, has an awesome work ethic and is really committed to his craft. And so I think just that as he has an opportunity to kind of put in all of that work, that you see him start to clean up parts of his game that aren't always the most helpful thing. And then in addition to that, if he can become the more consistent shooter, then he becomes, you know, one of the legitimately one of the very best point guards in the league. And I mean, if you said, Glenn, how likely
players in the league
for sure. Yeah. But I'm talking about like, you know, with a league with like Dame Lillard, and if we call Luka a point guard, like putting a guy in like that top three or four, that's really something, you know, right, in that category, then that's what he becomes in my mind. How likely is it? I can't tell you, you know, from a mental standpoint of like, can he become a guy who makes jump shots when he's tired? I mean, that's where the great shooters and the good shooters kind of get separated, just little areas like that. We'll see, but he has all of the raw, you know, kind of baseline skills to basically become, you know, as elite as the elite point guards in the league, in my mind, just needs more time and more work.
Right. I mean, that he does have things that can be polished up on to improve on what he's already been, which is through three games in the series, 34 points a game, 4 boards, 6 assists, shooting nearly 60% from two on 33% usage. I mean, he's having an insane series as this player who is, as you kind of put it, just sort of raw. Is, yeah, if I'm Memphis, I'm like, yeah, the sky is the limit. He could be. I think, you now, again, after having seen this in the playoffs, you can now start to really consider the idea that you might have your franchise's Damian Lillard. I guess maybe Grizzlies fans already thought that, but again, maybe more skeptical people were like, oh, do they need something else? Does he ultimately need to be the two? Like, no, I think with player development, Ja Morant is on a superstar sort of trajectory. The more important team, though, I guess, in this series is the one seed, the Utah Jazz, who really have not, I mean, they're up 2-1 right now in this series, but have not separated themselves much. They certainly don't look like a one seed, I would say, just having watched these three games. What, how this played out in the first three games kind of impacted your view of Utah as just even a contender in the West to win their next series if they are able to get out of this one?
Yeah, I think it's brought attention to some mostly fair questions about are they your prototypical kind of one seed? I think on the face of it, we can say probably not, because they don't have, you know, most teams who do that have an obvious top five or top 10, whatever you want to say, kind of player in the league that they're built around. And right, they don't have that. In that way, they remind me of the 60-win Hawks team, you know, that got the first seed. And when they got to the finals and gets LeBron, who, you know, arguably, obviously the best player in the league for some time, they just had nothing for that situation. And so I think that there are fair questions. I don't want to say that there's never a path for a team like that. I just think it can be a pretty narrow path, depending upon, you know, who else wins in the first round and kind of who else advances. I personally think this series is done. I don't know. Memphis may win one more, but similar to kind of when I texted you that I thought the Knicks were done, I thought in game three, Utah completely broke Memphis's pick and roll coverage. And similar to the 100%. Situation for the Knicks on offense, I don't see a solution on defense. And a lot of that comes down to, I tweeted last night in the middle of the game that, you know, God bless Taylor Jenkins for being this committed to playing Jaren Jackson Jr. in this playoff, getting him this playoff experience. He's so brutal defensively, but it's not like there's this obvious, like, you know, say 11-year, you know, vet over there that can come in and just give you really solid kind of play at the four, you know, or the five. But I think that Utah, with all their playmaking and their ball sharing and how precise they are in running their strong side and, you know, flipping it to the kind of the weak side or second side offense, is just completely you know, expose the Grizzlies for not having guys at the four and five that can kind of move quite well. I mean, as solid as Tillman has looked at times, as good as Brandon Clark can kind of be at times, you know, they need rim presence and rim protection. And that's something that on paper, on the combination of Valanciunas and Jackson, give you, but Jackson is an absolutely terrible decision maker. I still, you know, the normal optimistic lens, I'm still hopeful he can kind of figure it out and all of that. But I honestly think that going forward, the Jazz probably went out from here. But that it's still been a good outcome for the Grizzlies to throw this team and this roster into this environment and get that feedback loop. So, I mean, Ja is a team I think you can kind of put all of your belief in. But I think you realize that they need a bit of a different construction defensively to be able to kind of go into, you know, almost any playoff series, especially in the Western Conference, and have, you know, enough kind of, you know, defensive you know, stability and competence to be able to kind of hold up and not get your team completely broken the way that they've been in the series.
Right. And you bring up the pick and roll there. And looking at it from the Utah side, I think it's been super interesting to watch how the dynamic of their pick and roll changes when Conley is initiating the pick and roll with Gobert versus when Mitchell is initiating the pick and roll with Gobert. And Conley is about reading the action on the floor and quote unquote making the right play, right? Finding Gobert on the roll, finding the kick to whatever corner might be. Like he's figuring that all out like a quarterback, and it's particularly against a limited defensive team like the Grizzlies are, it just seems like money in the bank and you could just run that every time. Yet they got to get Mitchell involved too. And Mitchell's like going through the motions and he's still getting that screen from Gobert, but he isn't getting downhill into like quarterback mode ready to make the play. Like, he's more so looking for his own shot. And that's because he's more of a shot maker than, and he's not a pure point guard the way Conley is. But it's this weird, when I watch them, it's just, it's a little uncomfortable for me when I'm watching Mitchell be the initiator right there, because it doesn't seem congruent with the rest of their roster. Now, if he's making shots, it doesn't really matter. But as I look forward with this Jazz team, it's like, I think their formula for beating someone, one of these really talented teams in the second or third round, it's about just kind of out teaming them, right? And kind of more the Conley path. Yet Mitchell's such a big part of this too. And I think that maybe the normal thought process is like, no, you just go through your shot maker. What have you seen as kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm out on an island here, but it's felt a little bizarre to me when Mitchell's going.
Yeah, it is weird. And it's funny, when I saw the outline you sent through, I remember the game that Mitchell, I don't know if you remember this, but the Mitchell game in Philly, I want to say 2 full years ago, where he had, I think, 31 field goal attempts and no assists. Do you remember that game?
Yeah.
Greg,
I do remember that.
Greg was at that game. My brother Greg was at that game live, and I had a chance to ask him later on. I was like, did you know that was going on? He said he was shocked after the end of the game to realize that's what had happened. But not many guys can do that and not have their reputation kind of torched. But I'm pretty pro Donovan, but I think that you have to be honest and say that he is a bit limited as a creator. You know, it's interesting. We could have a long conversation about the path that he took to the league and how, you know, I think all the mocks when he was coming in had him in the 15 to 22 range, even if that, right. You know, and stuff. And, you know, he was a baseball player, serious baseball player for a while, and didn't have all of the typical kind of AAU and high school experience where he was the guy. And in fact, he was really never that. Even in Louisville, he was never that. And, you know, and once he got put into kind of workout situations in the pre-draft processes and stuff, people started to realize, like, wow, his combination of, you know, athleticism and speed and length, and he was just good enough with the ball, you know, kind of in that environment to think like, well, this is kind of a really good lottery ticket. You know, I think I had him fourth on my board by the time he came out, but I'll be honest, that was a lot to do with his raw speed and his leaping ability. And what I thought he'd be kind of one of those guys who's, you know, gives most of his value defensively and is a good enough secondary kind of creator on offense. But, you know, the thing for me, Dane, to kind of answer your question after a, you know, circular setup, if I go, for me, when I watch the Jazz, and, you know, it takes me back again, like I said, to the 61 Hawks team. And what always kind of broke that team the few times that they broke was when they couldn't produce anything offensively, and the best teams attack their offense as a team. But when everything breaks down, you can throw the ball to your best guy and he can produce some reasonably valuable looks. That's what you get with Mitchell that you don't typically see on a team like this, is he's willing to take tough shots. He's willing to take shots in tough moments and pressure filled moments. He's been historically an above average, if not more than that, kind of shot maker in moments like that. And so he has, I hate when people use like the word heart or whatever, you know, but he just has a willingness to kind of step up and take shots like that that not every player has. So, you know, if he were like a really dominant on-ball player, I don't think they would ever get the team stuff they get offensively, but they have something that a lot of teams that are built like that have. When it all breaks down, he's willing to try to take on that role, and he's been pretty competent at it in the past. And that's what makes me kind of scratch my head and think, do they have a better shot than I think, because they have another option that a lot of teams built like them don't? And I try to answer that question even kind of within my own, you know, mental processes. And it's super hard for me to land an answer in terms of, you know, what odds do I think they have of actually getting to the finals? You know, I don't think it's super high, but maybe I'm not giving them enough credit for how they can handle different kinds of adverse situations where they have a little bit more to work with than most teams that are built like them do.
I mean, isn't the answer just kind of that they have to pass that baton perfectly? Like, they have to play that team game while simultaneously going to Mitchell when they need the shot creation too. Like, yeah, I think if they do that perfectly, like, they can beat a lot of these teams in the West. It just I guess in these two games now that Mitchell has played, it has not felt like a smooth baton pass. Right. And, you know, maybe we see more through the rest of this series or whatever, but I was like, about a month ago, I was talking to Britt on the pod about this, and I was, and this is when the Lakers were really floundering and stuff. I was working on a, like, Utah out of the West, like being, you know, winning the West take, I guess you would call it, kind of after Jamal Murray went down. And I was like, I just think that they can kind of, I think they can just out execute a lot of these other teams when, you know, the Lakers were, would be the team that could out talent them, but they weren't looking like that. And I think I was just watching a lot of the Jazz then when they were playing without Mitchell, who was out with his ankle injury. And I kind of, in my head, was like, oh, well, they look awesome right now. And now they're just going to get this added bonus of a great shot creator, right? And so it's addition by addition. But in these two games, it's been less congruent than I thought. Not to mention, you know, you lost the first game of the series to the eighth seed. And, you know, you're keeping it really close against a team that's nowhere near as talented as you. It's like, it's caused me to back off on any sort of kind of optimism that I would have about Utah even winning next round against Dallas or the Clippers. Like, either of those teams, you're picking the Clippers or the Mavs, right?
I'd pick the Clippers. I don't know about the Mavs. It seems crazy, but at this point in time,
Maybe we're being too reactive. I don't know.
No, all season long, I thought the Mavs defense has just been terrible. And they don't really have anything to turn. They just, you know, they don't protect the rim. And they don't, you know, I mean, they have some useful, like Maxey is a good, versatile big man. But, you know, and Willie Cauley-Stein can do things like get out on the perimeter and recover back to the rim, but he's just not a good enough decision maker. And so I just feel like they're lacking the backline defenders you need to really do well in a series like that. But and even now, like, you know, I think, you know, I'm pretty low on the Clippers just because I think that they basically hate playing together. but I would for sure pick the Clippers to come out ahead of them unless the Clippers just, you know, set themselves on fire. With the Mavericks, you know, I think they had a hard time holding up to all the really good things Utah can do offensively, you know. But the point you made a few minutes ago was, don't they just rely on all their team stuff? And in the playoffs, I think that's,
like, we just call it team stuff. We both know what we're talking about,
right? Ball movement and, you know, clean DHOs and, you know, strong side to weak sides, you know, rotating the ball, all that stuff. But against a team in the playoffs that's really locked in on what you do, trust me, I speak from experience, oftentimes for stretches that turns into just perimeter shots. And any team is susceptible to just having a stretch where they stop making shots. And so it's sort of that whole cliche, live by the three, die by the three. But the Jazz, when they are just taking what the defense gives them, four stretches, that's going to turn into perimeter shots. And you can't just ever really control. I mean, you can't make shots for the perimeter on sheer will, you know. You know, right. Either they go down or they're not, for whatever reason. But that's where I think they become a little bit susceptible to an offensive drought at just the wrong time. You know, and that's where I see, like, the Clippers can play really, really well defensively. The Mavs is just not in them, you know. Right. And Luka, the workload on Luka is, like, crazy. But, you know, in terms of Utah getting out, like, can Phoenix knock off the Lakers? You know, how healthy, if the Jazz run up against Phoenix in that scenario, how healthy is Chris Paul? The Dallas can play at a really high level offensively. Their defense is garbage. The Clippers hate each other, you know? And so when I think about the Jazz coming out, I'm almost telling a story about the field rather than them. Even as good as they are, the field is kind of set for a team like them to make a run this year. And then I think it would be awesome to watch and a lot of fun if I'm kind of being a fan. On the net, the more of the analytical me looks at some of their limitations and thinking, like, you know, they need a kind of a particular path to get there, in my view.
Right. I think that could, like, everybody's going to be super locked on Bucks Nets in the second round, but that could low key be one of, if not the best, you know. The Bucks Nets is going to be the best second round series. But, like, I think Utah versus Dallas or the Clippers, you know, could be could be really fascinating because, I mean, look at all these questions we have, you know, right. And we've watched them all season and we've watched them, you know, play through this. It's basically like this idea of how do these identities that we understand well from having watched these teams played all season, how do they translate to the playoffs? And we don't really know that really well with Utah. We don't really know that all that well with Dallas or with the Clippers either, because none of them have really shown it on a playoff stage, and or not to mention against each other.
Or Phoenix, or in a way, this version of the Lakers, on and on, right?
Right, right. That's why these playoffs are awesome. The team that's getting buried, and this will be our kind of last topic. We're not going to dig too far into the X's and O's of Wizards Sixers, but I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Sixers because, I mean, as we do move into the second round here, eventually, again, all the focus is going to be on Bucks Nets. There's going to be probably the Lakers in the second round. Everything and the Sixers. I mean, no offense to your Hawks, are probably just going to probably beat up the Hawks and win this series and have the what people have been saying from the beginning. Like, they got the super easy path to the Eastern Conference Finals. Has the combination of what's happened here in these 2 weeks since the season ended, has anything happened, whether it be specifically to the Sixers and what you've seen in these three games, or to the field, as you called it before, has anything shifted that has changed your perception on what Philly is as a contender, like a winning the championship contender?
Yeah, so the thing for me that's changed a little bit is to watch how Embiid has increasingly become a guy who relies on a face-up game instead of trying to function in the post. I think we would agree that he's a really limited passer. He's been really, really turnover prone. And one of the ways that Doc's staff has really addressed that and made him a more impactful and efficient player, I made a note earlier, he averaged 28.5 a game on 63.6 true shooting percentage. That is bonkers. That is ridiculous. And it's really ridiculous for a guy who doesn't really shoot the three, you know. Now he lives at the free throw line, we know that, but that's because nobody can physically handle him. But, you know, with the most fascinating part of this team is the whole trend in the league of people going away from big guys, especially on offense, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The post is dead, all that conversation, which, you know, conversations like that are never fully true or false. You know, there's something in the middle. But the fact that they've converted him to basically a face-up player and they give him a chance to see the floor, he's a better passer. He sees the passes better, obviously, than when he has his back to the floor and can't really see the second defender coming and all that stuff. You know, I'm intrigued. I'm a little higher on them, even though the Wizards are atrocious on defense. Just the tactics of what they do with him individually on offense, I think, sets him in a better place and creates a situation where some of the previous downside that came along with him is lessened. And in my mind, I think, for example, in a matchup with the Nets, who in the hell is going to guard him on that Nets team, you know? And even with the Bucks, you could see kind of, you know, Brooke taking, you know, trying to take a lot of those minutes, but I'm sorry, but Brooke's just not going to be able to do anything for him. And the question you ask yourself in those situations is, if he is like your engine, can he give you enough if the Nets are putting up, you know, 125 a game against you and you know, and things like that? That's a wonderful question to have going to that series that we don't have to have an answer for. But I'm higher on the Sixers now than I was probably a couple months ago as a result of them kind of further committing to Embiid, the face-up player.
So the way I think about Joel Embiid this season, whenever I start, you know, as I was taking notes for this or whatever, the thing, when I watch Joel Embiid this year, which granted, you know, I'm obviously not an all 82 or all 72 Sixers watcher, but I think Joel Embiid was the best player in the NBA this season. I think Nikola Jokic was the MVP, but just in like, if I could isolate for all the games of basketball I watched this season and put that all in a pile and grab out the player who played the best in the time when I was actually watching the game, it's Joel Embiid, and it's not even close in how I kind of compute that in my head. And maybe that's happenstance of who I was watching and all those sort of things. As great as Nikola Jokic was, like pound for pound, I think Joel Embiid was the best player in the NBA this year. And now maybe some people don't agree with that, or maybe that sort of narrative has just gotten buried in the idea that people don't believe in him due to the injuries and, you know, they're discounting it because he only played 50 games or whatever, 45, whatever he played. And I just go back to talent in the playoffs so often. And if I can trust the coaching staff enough, which I think I can in Philly with Doc, like, I think I'm going to oftentimes, like, rely on who I think is the most talented player. And if they do get to the conference finals, you know, either Giannis is going to be coming on off an awesome series where he just beat Brooklyn, or KD or Harden are going to be coming, have gone off an awesome series and going to look like one of the, like, the best player in the league. But there's a situation that I think I would almost bet on that in that series, if Joel Embiid is healthy, that he will be the best player in the Eastern Conference Finals, even against, like, fully loaded Giannis, fully loaded Kevin Durant. Now, I don't know. I'm not guaranteeing that or anything like that. But when I put my finger to the wind and Twitter or whatever it might be, and it says I don't think that that's the perception of Joel Embiid, and I think that's kind of unfair. And his dominance, as you highlighted in those statistics, it's just kind of been a fact that when he's played, he has been just an absolute force, and in my opinion, the greatest force in the league, pound for pound, this season.
Yeah, I know. I think that's all fair. I do think the average NBA fan has no idea how good Joel Embiid is. I think we collectively, even though I don't necessarily buy into this, I'll still say all of us contribute in whatever way, that we see as, oh, Embiid is the guy who plays the defense. Jokic doesn't play. And Jokic has all the passing bag, you know, and the creation bag that Embiid doesn't have. And that's just way oversimplified. I mean, to start with, Jokic has been so much better defensively this year than he's been in prior years.
For sure.
But he's not on a Gobert and Embiid level, obviously. That's not the standard we're ever going to, you know, have for him. And then, you know, for Embiid, I just think that, you know, he's not, you know, him taking his little face up, step back, you know, 15-footer, it's just not something that's going to show up on Twitter or highlights, you know, like a crazy Jokic pass or whatever. And, sure, you know, and stuff. And I just think that that kind of factors into what the collective or the consensus view of a player is. You know,
I think that's what I'm talking about when, like, I sit down and watch a full 48 minutes right of a game, you know, like, what, I don't know what the word is, like, for calling that, but, like, when you extract out the value of those players, when you're actually watching, like, a full game, in the way, when, again, like a lot of fans, they just watch only their team in full games. It's just crazy to watch a Sixers game when Embiid's clicking, which is all, has been the majority of the games this season. He has been an unstoppable force.
Right. Yeah. And he's the guy who I would say, when he's that, the other 29 teams in the league, there's literally nothing you can do. I mean, there's nothing you can do, mm-hmm, except hope he misses shots. You know, I can obviously, like, we talk about KD is basically a 7-footer who can just get to a jump shot and shoot over any defender. And that's true. But, like, if I could kind of break down KD's game, just one little example is when he has the ball in that mid/extended post, I could tell you he starts with his back to the play. And before he dribbles, he's functioning as a passer. Once he takes his first dribble, he is 100% functioning as a shooter. And there's never any crossover between the two. And so that reality itself creates some predictability that a defense can kind of attune to and say, we're going to treat him as a passer before he dribbles. After he dribbles, we're going to run a second defender at him and make him shoot over two shooters because he's not going to pass the ball after he takes his first triple, you know. And that's just that kind of analysis and that kind of, you know, floor reading for a defensive unit just doesn't come into play, you know, for Embiid. I mean, first of all, if he's the step back, he has enough force in kind of getting into you to get to that, that you cannot get to, you can't get to him. There's no way to kind of really get to him once he's doing that. With Harden, you know, he has a history of kind of running out of gas, of course, and becoming a guy who's missing a lot of shots. And there's some things you can do to kind of, you know, maybe, you know, move Harden further along in that kind of fatigue cycle, where I just think with Embiid, yeah, you can try to make the Sixers feel pressure to play in 41, 42 minutes, which is a ton for a guy of his size. But no one else in the league, literally no one else in the league, when they kind of get into their primary back, not even, you know, kind of a secondary thing or whatever, no one can kind of put themselves in a category where there's nothing that the team can do like Embiid. And it's going to be fascinating to see. Sorry, Hawks fans. Sixers are going to win that series. Hawks fans are excited because the Hawks have done well against the Sixers. You know, the last since Trey came in the league, for the most part, but it's not a reliable sample. And the reality is that I just don't know what you do with him except run a second defender at him right away and force someone else to make plays. But, you know, Simmons is good slashing. He's good.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is like, so what are, I mean, I think what we're coming down to is like, what are those other guys going to provide for the Sixers, or how much do they need to provide?
And that's where
if Embiid's going to be that.
Right. And that's where having an elite shooter like Seth on the team has really moved the needle for them. They didn't have that, you know, before they added Seth. Now, we could talk about, you know, what did they lose to Josh Richardson? That was an awesome trade, you know, for the Sixers to add one of the three or four best shooters in the whole league, you know, at that position, especially since Thibault was ready to kind of step up, and they added Danny Green, you know, a very, you know, reliable on, you know, on ball point attack defender. You know, for me, I feel like every playoff game I watch, Danny Green either goes 6 for 6 or 1 for 9, you know? And so it's like, what do you get from him? And that I trust Seth all the time as a shooter. Is Simmons going to, you know, Simmons has gotten better at like not losing his mind, you know, with any sort of, you know, frequency the way he did in the past and things like that. I think that probably has to do with not only how deep Doc's coaching staff is, but just how much continuity there is in his staff, the guys that he always has around him and all of that. So I think the team is set up in a really good environment. I think that they have their head on straight. I think that a lot of the drama that's kind of, you know, kind of drained them a little bit of their, you know, success and, you know, positive energy. And I mean, even Tobias Harris had his best season in the league. You know, I didn't even mention him until just now, and he's been so good this year. So I actually love Philly's chance to get out of the East, even though I think we all have to say on paper, I don't know how you put someone above Brooklyn. But with Brooklyn, I want to see, like, can their coaching staff help their team when things get hard? You know, that's a real question. And will, KD and Harden work together instead of my turn, your turn, you know, when things get hard? And I just think we won't know that. I'm not saying they'll fail. I'm not saying, oh, they suck. I'm just saying, I don't think there's any way to know until we see them in that moment where there's adversity and things are not coming easily to them. And so for that reason, I think I stacked the Sixers up, you know, really quite well. I guess I'd put them over the Bucks to get out, and I'd put them.
I mean, let's just math this out. Like, is the smart bet to say Philly out of the East? Like, if we're putting odds on it, simply because, you know, I think we both are in agreement that like Brooklyn's the best team, but like the chessboard's set up in a way here where like Brooklyn could be the best team and still has an X percent chance to lose to Milwaukee. Like, I'm in the camp of, I think Brooklyn's going to win the championship. So like, but this is somewhat unprecedented that arguably Brooklyn and Milwaukee are two of the three best teams right now in the league, maybe. And they have to play each other. So that just kind of cuts down your odds in half or whatever, however you want to do it. Right. Whereas like Philly's going to be there already. I know Vegas odds don't reflect this, but it almost seems like the smarter logical bet is just to take Philly coming out of the East.
Yeah, I'm not as high on Milwaukee as you and I think a lot of other people. I'm not anti, you know, Giannis or whatever.
You just hate Bud.
Well, no. I think it's funny. I think Bud's a really, really good coach. I think he's not alone in that he's pretty stubborn in the playoffs, you know. That's, like I said, he's not alone at all. I talked about this with Brad Rolland on his podcast recently, but I was just saying that that's the norm. That's not an exception for an NBA coach to be stubborn in the playoffs. You know, but for me, I don't really believe Milwaukee has enough creation. I think, for example, even when Giannis and Drew are on and Middleton's off, that it's just too easy to force them to take, you know, off the dribble jump shots. And I just think that they don't have enough creation to kind of go deep. I still think they're missing that. It's, I half jokingly, you know, said on Twitter like a week ago that I feel like the Bucks are one Bogdanovich away from being a real contender, you know, and, you know, and I probably never say that if I don't have so many Hawks followers, you know, and things like that, but they just really are lacking one more guy. And that's not necessarily just about like what the Nets team is this year, but I think the Nets, while not awesome defensively, are smart enough and experienced enough to know how to force Milwaukee to do things that aren't their forte. And so I think like Brooklyn wins at a reasonably comfortable six games there. And I think we get Brooklyn Philly. And I think like, I want to take like 2 weeks off from work and like do nothing but live and breathe and eat and sleep like that series and stuff like that. I think it'll be awesome. And I think it's one of those things where if I like said, okay, I really think after looking at this mathematically, say I think the Sixers are like a 55% favorite in that matchup. You feel so dumb even saying that out loud, like even not on a podcast or whatever. You know, you just feel so dumb. But I think they're right there with Brooklyn to get out of the East in my mind. Maybe I end up looking foolish about that, but I just think, like I said before, so much of that just comes down to, you know, there's nothing they can do with Embiid. And then to your question, you know, can they get enough juice out of Simmons, Harris, Seth, Green, you know, can they avoid having an opposing team make Tybal look like, a dysfunctional Roberson. Kind of non-shooter.
Robertson.
Yeah, exactly. That's the kind. So, you know, they're not super, super deep. Can Dwight keep doing the simple, basic kind of, you know, hard work kind of things about all the glory and things like he dealt with Lakers last year, but you know, there's this guy named LeBron on that team, you know? So, I mean, there's some fair questions about Philly, but I think it's one of those things like I might say I would have them as my favorite by just a few percentage points and feel, like I said, dumb as a rock for even putting that out there.
No, you got to consider the bracket in there. And like we said, the fact that Embiid, I think Embiid deserves that credit. And now maybe what we're not factoring in is obviously the whole injury thing. That's just so annoying that we have to calculate that into every Embiid equation, but we do. You and I have been doing podcasts in the playoffs for years now and talking about series in this sort of way. I've never had a year where I feel as many question marks when we're talking about a specific series or how things could play out. I mean, most of the time, back on your podcast when we used to do it all the time, it's just like, yeah, like I could be wrong about this series, but like probably not, you know, it would like something this it's like, I don't know. Like we just went through the West with the Jazz and that Clippers and Mavs. And we don't know who's going to come out of that. Like,
right.
we don't know who's going to now that the Phoenix won today. Like,
and AD got hurt. Right.
I mean, yeah, I guess it makes a lot of the analysis harder, but it just the viewing experience and kind of the, you talk about the take 2 weeks off and just think about the thinking about stuff of it is so fun. I mean, I'm sure you've been doing the same thing with your basketball friends too, where it's like, you know, just texting back and forth, like, oh, is Brooke Lopez going to be able to even stay on the floor against the Nets, or is this and that? And there's just all of these question marks about all of these really good teams that we're going to have to see it actually play out in a game or two once the series starts to be able to learn kind of what direction things are pointing.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like the one thing I was sure of coming into this playoffs was that the Heat had nothing for the Bucks. I mean, I was like, they have nothing for the Bucks. But then that might make you think, well, Glenn's really high in the Bucks. Not really. You know?
See, it's just weird. It's just all weird.
Yeah, and then like in the West, it's like, I saw Lakers-Suns as like a 50-50 series, mostly because I thought they were catching the Lakers, you know, fortuitously early before LeBron and AD kind of got in the, you know, real game shape. And then CP got hurt, and then he looked good today, and then AD got hurt, and I don't know what it's like. I think that's maybe back to a 50-50 series. I mean, you always have to put the LeBron factor kind of in there that he always tends to figure it out. But, you know, that's there. I think Clippers-Mavericks, despite how, you know, horrible I think the Mavs defense is, the Clippers could beat themselves, basically, and open the door. And if they open the door at all, Giannis could get his foot in there and be like, I'm here, and I am now on this series. And so we talk about like who's coming out of the East. Like, I'm way more perplexed in the West. It wouldn't shock me if like one of maybe five different teams, you know, let's see, Lakers, Clippers, Suns don't shock me. Utah doesn't completely shock me. I guess that's where I wrap up. I mean, I don't think Portland has like the juice.
But how many times have we been able to say that?
Not, I mean,
ever.
It took the Warriors becoming this basically.
That's true.
You know, I think for us to kind of get there, and then for LeBron to be on a team that's where last year they did so much damage through their, you know, their basically their lob threat centers, Dwight and JaVale, you know, et cetera. And they punted on all that this year for some stupid reason. And they don't have enough shooting at this. You know, it's like, are we just trying to make LeBron's, you know, or is LeBron in a video game where we're just turning up the, you know, the difficulty, you know, settings so harder and harder. So, man, it's kind of crazy. I mean, I'm kind of fortunate that no one's asked me, Glenn, who's your pick to come out of the West? Because I honestly just really don't know how I'll come up with an answer except to say, well, if I don't know, I guess I'm going to trust LeBron to figure it out. And that's the best I got.
That's what makes it a blast, man. Well, we'll have to come back and see how stupid all of our thoughts here sound a couple weeks from now. Maybe we'll talk again once the Hawks and Sixers are squared up in the second round. When will that series start? Like a week?
It depends on when it ends. I think there's some expectation that Game One could be on Sunday, a week from today.
Okay. Well, anyways, he is Glenn Willis. Glenn, thanks for doing it. I really appreciate it. Took more of your time than I thought I would, but it's always fun to just, you're one of the smartest basketball people I know, and it's fun to just, you know, chop it up and go through these series. It's I'm having a blast watching every one of these series every night, and it's honestly, I just feel like I'm on overload, just mainlining NBA playoff basketball into my veins. But it's been, you know, it's been a blast. And so thank you for doing it. You guys can all you can follow Glenn on Twitter @Willis_Glenn. It'll be in the show notes and everything there. He's always posting a bunch of Hawks stuff, Hawks videos and all that sort of thing. I feel like I learn stuff from your Twitter. So thanks for that, Glenn, and I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, much appreciated too. And if and when the Hawks do lose, the Hawks don't win the championship, I will increasingly put more content, like technical content, out about the, you know, semifinal, conference semifinals and finals and stuff. So if you like just don't feel like doing Hawks content for whatever crazy reason, more variety is very likely on its way. And thanks for having me, Dane. Appreciate all the kind words and for having me on.
Yes, sir. I will be back in a few days with Britt. We'll chop up some more of the series. I'm going to have Jack Borman on. We're going to kind of look at the playoffs through a Timberwolves lens, kind of like Glenn and I were doing with John Collins. So again, this is kind of the new sort of cadence of the podcast with the Timberwolves season over. We're looking at things through a playoff lens. I appreciate you sticking with the pod. Again, thanks to Glenn Willis for coming on. I will talk to you next week. Peace out. Feeling man, I hope it never stop, yeah. Green and hot so you can find me in the crowd, yeah, yeah. Don't let standards ever bring you down, yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.